From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. They call it public diplomacy, the State Department's attempts to enlighten a skeptical world about American policy and American values by engaging media and opinion leaders abroad. For the Bush administration, this hasn't been going so well. Survey after survey demonstrate that the U.S. is seen as ever more arrogant and its policies ever less attractive. Until recently, this so-called hearts and minds battle was the job of Price Floyd, former director of media affairs at the U.S. State Department. But in an op-ed piece in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, Floyd explained why he finally walked away from the job and a 17-year State Department career. He joins me now. Price, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bob. Glad to be here.
I've read your piece. You are one dispirited guy. Why?
As you said, I was at the State Department for 17 years, and a 17 years that was filled with amazing events around the world. And the biggest of those events was 9/11. Right after that happened, my office, I mean, other people in the State Department, really went into overdrive to push America's foreign policy and its goals in the battle against terrorism to an audience around the world. In the past, we would have an amazingly hard time trying to get any story or interview. But after 9/11, it was really easy. People were engaged. They wanted to know what we were doing to stop this and to fight this. But what I found in the 6 years since 9/11, as we were doing more of that, poll numbers and the opinions of the U.S. were going down. And so I started raising these kind of concerns in meetings. You know, it's not the package. It's the actual substance that people were having problems with.
So if public diplomacy isn't finding a good public relations way to justify your policies, what should public diplomacy be?
I think it should be two things. It should be through our actions, doing good deeds, you know, delivering humanitarian assistance to countries that need it. The Pakistan earthquake relief effort is a perfect example of that. We don't need to spin that or try to sell that. We just need to do it. The other half on public diplomacy is engaging publics overseas by having exchanges, bringing people here to America to see what we're about, sending Americans overseas. The U.S. government used to send speakers overseas during the Vietnam War to talk about freedom of speech. You can disagree with the government. And those speakers disagreed with our policies in Vietnam. And the message that sent was immense. I can't imagine this government sending speakers to different countries who disagreed with our policy in Iraq today.
What is it, then, about this government that can't grasp the difference between PR spin and genuine diplomacy?
PR spin has the potential to work fast. You put an ad out, you do a glossy magazine spread, which we tried to reach the air market called High Magazine. And if it works, the response can be quick. Public diplomacy takes time. It takes years. And people don't want to wait years.
After 9/11, there was this moment where there was just a huge outpouring of goodwill towards the United States. What did the State Department do wrong, and what should it have done 6 years ago?
Imagine if they had gone around the world like former Secretary Baker did in the lead-up to the Persian Gulf War. And therefore, by his actions, not just his words, but by his actions, he showed that he was talking to and listening to world leaders about what we should do. Imagine the kind of response we could have gotten there about Iraq in particular. First Persian Gulf War turned out completely different. Same thing in Kosovo. Our actions followed our words. Iraq, and when we said why we were going in, it didn't line up. And people know that. People aren't stupid. Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo added to that.
In the introduction, I took some pains to point out that you were a 17-year employee of the State Department. Are you just a guy who was a political malcontent from the beginning and took 17 years to finally split?
No, I was actually a big supporter of us going into Iraq. I believed, as most people did, that there were weapons of mass destruction, that Saddam Hussein had gassed and killed his own people, and the very idea of those kind of weapons getting in the hand of terrorists was frightening. When we went in, we didn't find anything. When asked by the press, would you have do the same thing if you'd have known what you know now? The right answer would be, of course not. We wouldn't go in. If he didn't have weapons of mass destruction, he couldn't harm anyone, why would we go in? But that's not what they said. They said, I'd do the same thing again, even knowing there's no weapons. So if that's the administration's outlook, what possible information or ideas could I bring to the table that would be listened to.
I want to ask you about Karen Hughes, who is the current Hearts and Minds czarina. Do you think that she understands that there is a cognitive dissonance between our words and our actions?
I've met with her several times. She is one of the most dynamic people I have ever been around. She is truly impressive. But she comes at it from a press media angle. And public diplomacy, I don't think is that. I think now, I mean, this is bigger than Karen Hughes. It's bigger than the State Department. It's going to mean an administration change. Someone new is going to have to come in, no matter who that is, Republican or Democrat. I think people around the world would give them the benefit of the doubt, at least at first. But having a press conference is not going to take care of anything.
Well, Price, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Price Floyd is currently Director of External Relations for the Center for New American Security, a bipartisan Washington think tank. He was formerly Director of Media Affairs for the U.S. Department of State.
This Tuesday marks the 40th anniversary of the Six-Day War between Israel and its Arab neighbors, including most directly Egypt, Syria, and Jordan. Like most events in the region, the war has a different name and meaning and mythology, depending on which side of the proverbial line in the sand you're standing. What the Israelis call the Six-Day War, emphasizing its quick and decisive victory, the Palestinians call An-Naqsa, or the setback. Whatever you call it, says Jeffrey Goldberg of The New Yorker, June of 1967 was year zero for how the media would go on to cover the conflict over the following four decades. And he joins me now. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So could you remind us first what exactly the catalyst was? It had to do with a maritime blockade by Egypt that effectively cut off Israel from the Red Sea.
The act of war, I guess you would say, would be the closing of the Straits of Tehran that blocked Israel's access to the Red Sea. One of the signals the Israelis took that hostilities were imminent was when Nasser ordered the UN peacekeeping forces out of the Sinai and started moving his tanks and troops into the Sinai. And all that led up to the decision by Israel in the morning of June 5th to launch a preemptive attack on Egypt and Syria's air bases and destroyed the air forces of those two countries.
So before we talk about the coverage of this lightning war from the outside, what was the role of the media in the region leading up to and including those 6 days? I know TV wasn't so widespread, but was radio a force?
Radio was a huge force, and you could blame the power of radio at the time for two things. One was to convince Israelis that a second Holocaust was coming, because the state-run radios of these countries, and that's all they had, were broadcasting into Israel these dire threats about the coming end of the Jewish state. The other aspect of this, which is interesting, is that, again, these state-owned radio stations broadcast falsehood after falsehood once the war had started about the progress the Arabs were making on the ground, when in fact they were being thrown back. And so Arab citizens of these countries had no idea what was really happening until it was all over.
Was there anything surprising about the media coverage outside, from Britain or the continent or the U.S.?
It's absolutely fascinating, actually. If you don't mind, I'll read you something from Time magazine that was from their June 9 issue, which I guess was published right before the war began. Tiny, dagger-shaped Israel, Time reports, whose 2.7 million people cling to 7,900 square miles on the shore of the eastern Mediterranean, faced the implacable hostility and cocked guns of 14 Arab nations and their 110 million people. This sort of blatantly pro-Israel viewpoint was apparent not only in Time, but in the other news weeklies and the daily newspapers and on the three networks. And the really amazing thing is if you go back into the BBC archives, you'll see that kind of sympathy as well for Israel. One of the astonishing things to remember, and this is 40 years ago, was that Israel was considered by the media to be the underdog in this conflict. Israel was seen as this plucky outpost of Judeo-Christian values, battling these monstrous Arab dictatorships. And so the coverage remained very, very sympathetic for years to come.
And you've said that in the coverage of this war were the seeds of Israel's hubris.
You know, and this is where it becomes very interesting from a media perspective. Israel now, of course, believes it has a media problem, and it really does, especially in Europe, where if, you know, Israel discovered a cure for AIDS, some European media outlets would spin that negatively. And it has a media problem because of something that has roots in the Six-Day War, and that's the settlements. In the general wave of excitement that followed the Six-Day War, Israel really could do no wrong in the eyes of the Western world. And it took that support as license to do any number of things, ultimately self-destructive for Israel. First and foremost, the settlement movement. It's one thing, from a perspective of international law and morality, to occupy territory from which you're being attacked. Jordan opened fire on Israel in June of 67 from the West Bank. Israel seized the West Bank. That's one thing. But then moving your own citizens into that territory and building settlements, that's another category.
And is that the point at which the conflict flipped from Israelis being the underdog to the Arabs being the underdog?
Well, that's a fascinating question. Israel was clearly the underdog in 1967. Palestinians didn't really have a voice yet. Remember, Palestinians had been under military occupation by Jordan and the West Bank and Egypt and the Gaza Strip from 1948 to 1967. But Palestinian nationalism grew and developed. And over the years, the conflict has been recast, if you will, as instead of one between Israel and 20 different Arab states, in which, you know, you could pretty much easily identify the underdog, to one between Israel and these occupied Palestinians.
You've drawn distinctions between occupation on the one hand and settlement on the other in the region. Is this something you think most journalists get wrong about the Six-Day War and the byproducts thereof?
Well, you know, I speak about this not infrequently in front of pro-Israel audiences. And one of the questions I always get is, how come when the media writes about the occupation of the West Bank, they don't say why Israel was in the West Bank in the first place? And my answer to that is, this is journalism. It's not history. I would like to begin every story that I write about the Middle East with,
5,000 years ago.
5,000 years ago, a man named Abraham walked from Iraq to Israel. Yesterday in Gaza, the problem here is that you're dealing with a level of complexity that's mind-boggling.
Jeff, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Goldberg is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His most recent book is Prisoners, A Muslim and a Jew Across the Middle East Divide.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Hello, podcast listeners. Let me tell you about something new we're doing. In fact, I think we may be the last people on Earth to finally do it. We're launching our first blog, one that will chronicle our upcoming trip to Russia. I'll be there for 2 weeks, starting on June 4th, with producer Mike Bolo and technical director Dylan Keefe, to report on the much-beleaguered media there. You can follow our progress by clicking on the link at onthemedia.org. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Since the small Baltic nation of Estonia cast off Soviet rule in 1991, it has emerged as one of the world's most digitally advanced nations. Estonians use Wi-Fi all over the country. They shop, bank, and even vote on the net. Of course, this heavy dependence on technology can leave you vulnerable, a point driven home to Estonians last month after a disagreement with Russia. In April, the Estonian parliament voted to remove a World War II-era statue of a Soviet soldier from the capital, Tallinn. For Russians, the act showed a shocking disregard for Russia's fight to free the country from the Nazis. But for many Estonians, the statue symbolized years of oppression under Soviet rule. The conflict itself is an old story, but the retaliation against Estonia was new. It took the form of a highly organized, highly destructive cyber attack on Estonia's websites. Senior security researcher at Arbor Networks, Jose Nazario, says the attacks focused on Estonia's most important sites.
These include the Ministers of Finance, the Minister of Agriculture, the Parliament. A number of key government websites were in fact targeted in what we call a distributed denial of service attack. It's distributed because it comes from multiple sources around the world, in this case thousands of sources, and it's a denial of service attack because what they're trying to do is overwhelm the systems, both the network and the servers, with so many requests and so much traffic that they're unable to provide service to legitimate users.
This is not done necessarily by individuals sitting there at their computers and clicking on Estonian websites. This is a robotic attack.
Correct. In most cases, it is what you call a botnet attack, a network of computers that have been compromised, essentially turning them into robots or zombies, where they receive these attack commands and they follow them blindly.
As you mentioned, these attacks seem to be emanating from hither and yon, Vietnam, Brazil, you name it. But, you know, you have to assume that there would be no actual motive for the random Brazilian to be incensed at Estonians removing a Soviet monument from Tallinn. So what is happening here?
It's important to remember that a lot of these computers around the world participating in the attack are doing so without any of the owner's knowledge or consent. The people behind the attacks, however, that's a much different story. And these people often hide their tracks, especially in very high-profile attacks. And to discover that really requires a lot of traditional detective work. And right now, we have no evidence that the Russian government was behind any of this.
Hmm. You've observed that Estonia is particularly advanced in terms of digital infrastructure, and yet was quite vulnerable to this denial of service assault. What about the United States? Are we at a national security risk from Russia or anybody else?
We don't think so. Every day we track thousands of these kinds of attacks. The American government has really much, much beefier network resources available to it to withstand such attacks because they've been dealing with these for quite a while. And so it would take a very determined adversary to actually disrupt this.
I called this cyber warfare. Maybe it's more like cyber civil disobedience. I mean, is it even illegal?
It depends on the country. It is illegal in some countries for such attacks to take place. I think the UK has probably the most stringent computer security and attacker laws on the books. There has been some efforts to try and get some of these regulations codified around the world with some success, but not a whole lot. So it really depends on the jurisdiction.
Let's just say that this turns out not to have been either begun or facilitated by the Russian government, but that it's more or less a spontaneous response from ethnic Russians in Estonia and elsewhere in the diaspora. Which, though, is the greater threat?
You can, of course, negotiate with government. Dealing with the individuals can be much tougher. And if they're loosely grouped, if they simply just share a nationalistic streak as opposed to taking orders from a central organization, it's much harder, I think, to shut down such an effort because you have to go after each of those groups individually.
In a world in which dissidents are poisoned with polonium in foreign restaurants and Scotland Yard is rebuffed in its investigation, is there any reason to think that we'll ever get to the bottom of this particular episode?
The good news is that while it's easy for some nations to block access to resources within their jurisdictions, the internet, because it transcends a lot of national boundaries, there's a lot of data that can be gathered outside of those boundaries, really easing data collection. We don't physically have to go, for example, to Russian territory to find out if indeed the Russian government was behind these attacks.
Well, Jose, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Jose Nazario is a senior security researcher at Arbor Networks in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
While former members of the Soviet bloc squabble, let's consider a lesser-known chapter in our own struggle with the Red Menace. We've all heard of the Hollywood 10, the movie industry blacklist instigated from the top down by Senator Joe McCarthy, the House on American Activities Committee, and the predations of J. Edgar Hoover. But as David Everett lays out in his new book, A Shadow of Red, Communism and the Blacklist in Radio and Television, unlike the movie industry purge, the imposition of the broadcast blacklist was a bottom-up, grassroots affair instigated principally by five men. Three were ex-FBI agents, one a former military intelligence officer, and one a grocer from Syracuse. In 1950, with the Korean War on the horizon, the ex-agents published a booklet called Red Channels, which listed 151 suspected communist sympathizers in broadcasting, some famous and some not. But as Everett notes, for Red Hunters, rooting out famous infiltrators was less important because even the lowliest communist posed a threat.
Someone once asked them, what possible harm can there be if there was a communist sympathizer who was the third violinist in a studio orchestra? And the answer that they came up with is, well, the third violinist, he sits next to the first violinist, and he knows the engineer, and he knows an announcer, perhaps. So, in effect, anyone can be a possible security risk.
And so you have these three FBI agents in their newsletter called Counterattack and their magazine called Red Channels, where they list these people, mostly based in New York, who are members of Communist Front organizations that seem to champion good liberal causes like international peace, civil rights, workplace protections.
Of course, in the larger picture, as we know now, communists weren't just in favor of unemployment insurance and civil rights. Communist Party was involved in facilitating espionage in this country. And also what was going on is they were raising money for communist causes.
So you have this former naval intelligence officer scouting these people out. You have the grocer in Syracuse, New York, putting pressure on advertisers and through them the networks. How did the networks react?
Yeah, well, CBS, which was considered to be the most liberal network and as a result really became the first target of blacklisters, they caved in very quickly, instituted a loyalty oath. NBC, there were people who were blacklisted from their shows, but there were other people who might have been blacklisted but continued to work. Then at ABC, very early on, Gypsy Rose Lee, she had a talk show at the time, became the target of American Legionnaires who made certain charges against her. And ABC's response was, let's see the proof that you have for these charges. And then American Legionnaires essentially said, well, we just got it from Red Channels. You should really talk to them. Each person passed the buck. The net result was that she was not blacklisted. So there is a case of a network standing up to blacklisters, and they were able to get away with it.
It seemed that the consequences depended on how big a star you were. A relatively minor actress like Jean Muir could have her whole professional life disrupted, whereas Lucille Ball was another matter.
That gets to something that I thought was very important while I was researching this book. Obviously, anti-communists, no matter how zealous they are, have the right to talk about who might be a communist. But what gave them their true power was the fact that broadcasters, in effect, gave them their power, that they panicked. And when it came to people who were not that important, that often meant writers because they didn't really care about them at all, they would just immediately go ahead and get them off the airwaves. But then suddenly there was some information about Lucille Ball having some connection to the Communist Party going back to 1936. Suddenly, CBS developed a backbone and they stood up to the charges and nothing happened. There were no consequences.
So all of this is going on behind the scenes. How is it playing out on the small screen or on the radio?
You did hear, for instance, a radio show which was called I Was a Communist for the FBI.
Many of the incidents in the story you're about to hear are based on the actual records and authentic experiences of Matt Savetic, who for 9 fantastic years lived as a communist for the FBI.
As you can pretty much gather from the title, it was quite an alarmist show.
Was there any fighting back on the radio?
Actually, on TV, there was one show called You Are There, which actually involved the use of several blacklisted writers who were working on the show through fronts, people who would lend their names to the scripts of blacklisted writers. This was a show which recreated historical events and made it seem like they were news reports unfolding before the viewer's eyes.
Salem, Massachusetts, June 1692. CBS is there.
They very often would do stories which were clearly political parables. They did one about the trial of Galileo. They did one about the Salem witch trials. These parables got a lot of attention among certain people, but I think if you look at them now, they really don't come across as well. They came across as really stodgy recitations.
This morning, a prosecution witness, the Reverend Mr. Samuel Parris, minister of Salem Village, testified that the alleged unnatural activities of Rebecca Norse are actually part of a much larger plot against the government.
The blacklist effectively ended in broadcasting because of a lawsuit brought by a frustrated radio personality named John Henry Falk.
Yeah, he was someone who was known as a professional Texan, radio personality, a raconteur who appeared on CBS Radio. He was blacklisted in 1957. And what he did, unlike a lot of people, he decided to take a stand. This brought all the issues finally out into the open. John Henry Falk was awarded $3.5 million, which was the biggest award settlement for a libel case up until that time. And this is what really effectively ended the blacklist.
Did it shame the networks and the advertisers into some backbone?
Now they didn't need any backbone. It's interesting, years later, there was a movie about that trial called Fear on Trial, based on John Henry Falk's memoir, and was broadcast by CBS, who was certainly involved in his blacklisting. There's only one network that's mentioned in this TV movie as being involved in the blacklist, and that's ABC.
David, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
David Everett is author of A Shadow of Red, Communism and the Blacklist in Radio and Television.
In the 1990 mob movie Goodfellas, Robert De Niro tells a young Ray Liotta that there are two things to remember after being arrested. Always keep your mouth shut and never rat on your friends. At the end of the movie, Liotta is sitting with an FBI agent singing like a canary in exchange for his freedom and witness protection. Nearly 20 years later, in the wake of television shows like The Sopranos and The Wire, the criminal informant has become a thoroughly demonized figure, not just in popular culture, but in real life. So much so that a website is now devoted to shaming them, exposing not only informants, but a First Amendment puzzler. New York Times legal correspondent Adam Liptak wrote about whosarat.com, and he joins me now. Adam, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Who's behind this, and what is he up to?
The guy who founded the site is named Sean Bucci, and he was apparently indicted and since convicted on marijuana charges after being indicted on information provided by an informant. He started this site, I think, kind of as a little hobby, and it turned into something quite big. It allows people to post the identities of informants and undercover agents and relies very heavily on court documents. So it's public record information, but it's being used for what a lot of people think is a troubling end.
He was mad that confidential testimony put him at legal peril, and was this an act of revenge?
Yeah, on two levels. One, I think he was mad at the particular person who ratted him out, but he was also mad, and he's not alone in this, at a system which relies very heavily on informants who are paid in a way to say things by getting more lenient sentences.
And I guess, you know, if I'm the snitch, I don't only have to worry about the people in the contemporaneous prosecution. I also have to worry about ever going to prison again, where snitches are not well regarded and not well treated, as I understand it.
Well, that's right. The Justice Department contends that this will endanger people's lives. So they want to do something quite radical, which is to take all plea agreements, whether involving cooperating witnesses or not, off of the federal court's internet sites, and thereby really cut back on public access to what has long been thought to be public documents.
All right, so let's talk about the Constitution. Is there any legal way for the Justice Department or anyone else to intervene to cut off this flow of information to the public?
Well, there are two things they can do. One is to go after the site itself, and there are some plausible theories that at least some of the information they post might in fact amount to aiding and abetting or witness tampering or something like that, although that's the weaker of the two options. Probably the better of the two options is not the wholesale route that the Justice Department wants to go down, but a thoughtful piece-by-piece discussion with the judge in the given case about precisely what information ought to be sealed. And when it's sealed and needs to be sealed, it can be sealed constitutionally both in paper form and electronic form. But what the Justice Department wants to do instead is take a kind of shortcut, which is to leave the paper files as is and just cut off internet access. And that doesn't seem to be the best solution.
I want to get back to the website itself. Is there something that I'm missing here, some reason that this should not offend me to the core?
You know, I share that intuition, Bob. And yet after the story appeared, thoughtful defense lawyers contacted me and put postings on the New York Times' site in which they made the point that the more information out there, the better, that some of these informants make up stories in multiple cases in exchange for leniency, and that there is a societal value in getting information about them out.
To your knowledge, has anyone actually been harmed or threatened or intimidated in any way throughout the history of whosarat.com?
The Justice Department cites one example. In writing to the federal judiciary, they say that a witness they had in a Philadelphia operation had to be moved, and an investigation started after material from Hoosierat.com was posted on utility poles and cars and mailed to this guy's neighbors. That's the only one that they pointed to, and it didn't seem to end particularly badly for the witness, but it does give you a flavor for the sorts of things that could happen.
In the piece, you said that the rationale for this is, as someone put it to you, nobody likes a tattletale. But I teach my kids that sometimes you do have to tattle, not over things that are minor, but over things that are important. Has the culture so degraded that the question of informing on a criminal has become an open question?
There was a session at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice a week or two ago, which is a school of higher education that trains law enforcement officials. And there was an open session about whether it's appropriate to snitch. And among the students being trained in law enforcement, some of them took the position that it's not appropriate to cooperate with the police because the police can't be trusted. And this manifests itself in rap music, it manifests itself on T-shirts, and it does seem to be a societal movement or feeling with some force.
Okay, Adam. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Adam Liptak is the national legal correspondent for the New York Times.
Coming up, Nielsen measures ratings for commercials and an argument over who gets to represent the religious.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, at macfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Until now, Nielsen ratings have included only viewers who watch live TV, ignoring the 17% of homes that use DVRs. But this week, Nielsen released new ratings that include DVR watchers, and for the first time, measure audiences for commercials. The UK and other European countries have been gauging those audiences for 25 years, so Nielsen is hardly breaking new ground. What it is doing, says Marissa Guthrie from Broadcasting and Cable magazine, is responding to the demands of their client networks and advertisers, who need to find agreement on whether to count the growing mass of time shifters as viewers.
Advertisers and the networks demanded from Nielsen some sort of standard measurement to show if people are watching advertisements during DVR playback, and if they are, how many of them are, and are they watching them just in live plus one? Are they watching them in live plus three, in live plus seven?
You're talking about plus 7 days out from the original broadcast.
Exactly.
Which theoretically wouldn't much hurt the advertiser of, say, paper towels. But if you're Hollywood and trying to promote this weekend's blockbuster new film release, 7 days out probably would be not very useful at all.
No, and the movie studios will never pay for 7 days out. They don't want to pay for 3 days out. But for many advertisers, live plus 3 days out of viewing is fine.
But they're not getting any value at all if the ads are being fast-forwarded through. Some studies show that 7 out of 10 DVR users just skip past the ads altogether. Others have suggested that the number is closer to 4 out of 10. Is there any consensus on this percentage yet?
If there is, Nielsen is not revealing what it is. Their clients are reluctant to release that information wide. However, the new Nielsen data shows that some people, in fact, do let the DVR playback run through the commercial. Whether they're in the room when the commercial is on, no one knows.
For more than 2 years, we've been talking on this program about what happens when old media structures can no longer operate profitably and advertisers flee in droves. Do you have any reason to think that this will be the upfront market in which advertisers finally say, no more, we will no longer pay you more for less?
Well, I think even before Nielsen released data in this new standardized form, which they did this week, there had been some movement toward a consensus of the advertisers would pay for live plus 3-day viewing. When we reach a point where DVR penetration is upwards of 50%, there will have to be some radical shift. How that ultimately affects the creative process is still open to interpretation, but it will be much harder to mount these big, expensive tentpole shows like Grey's Anatomy. That's an ad-supported show.
Apart from trying to negotiate with advertisers for what kind of shelf life their ads have on a DVR, are networks doing anything else to try to keep people watching the ads instead of fast-forwarding through them?
There are many attempts. I mean, they are integrating stories throughout ad pods that start in the program and extend into the ad. They are having an advertisement start on the TV screen within the television program itself and then extend into the advertising pod. And certainly on broadband channels, everything is integrated, and actually there is no skipping on streaming video.
You made reference to integrating advertising messages into the programs themselves. It's come to be called branded entertainment. Is it being accepted by the public? I mean, there's a lot of really heavy-handed stuff out there.
Viewers are increasingly accustomed to this. And don't forget, Bob, I mean, that model is going back to, you know, Milton Berle and the Texaco men. And research shows that younger viewers are even more accepting of that sort of branded integration. The one thing to note is that branded integration is much easier with unscripted television. American Idol is sponsored by Coca-Cola. Extreme Makeover Home Edition, the sponsor is Sears. It's a little trickier to do it in a scripted series, but it's being done.
And in fact, NBC already announced that in the first hour of primetime, between 8 and 9 Eastern time, there will be no more new dramas and sitcoms, only reality programming, which is dimes on the dollar to produce relative to scripted dramas and sitcoms.
Yes. I mean, NBC certainly is not the leader there in fourth place, but you could be seeing a sad glimpse of the future.
Marissa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Bob.
Marissa Guthrie is a reporter at Broadcasting and Cable.
And now for a few of your letters. They focus mostly on the issue of media transparency, ours, that is. On my conversation with Jason Calacanis, co-founder of Weblogs, over whether or not journalists should post their raw interviews on the web, Samuel C. Blackman of Boston wrote that he was just about cheering out loud, quote, "I was recently burned by a newspaper reporter over comments made in my weblog, a weblog that deals with being a pediatric oncologist. I couldn't agree more with Jason's experience of feeling like the reporter was, quote, looking for the drama instead of objectively reporting the contents of the interview."
But Tim Lennon of London, England, takes issue with Mr. Calacanis. He doesn't want to hear all the multiple versions of questions, unedited tape, and, quote, all the other paraphernalia and what have you that goes into the show. What on earth would be then the point of listening to the show in the first place? Calacanis trusts OTM to edit properly and concisely, and so do I, which is why I so enjoyed the piece that followed about editing and production on radio. Not only was the piece interesting, but the timing was particularly apposite, as I've come to expect.
That piece about radio editing was by reporter John Solomon. Marcia Spies of East Sound, Washington writes, "Gasp! NPR edits its broadcasts. I would hope so. That's your job. Do you think a newspaper article prints verbatim from an interview? Subtly unethical," was the uneasy suggestion, putting one over on unsuspecting, trusting listeners. Poppycock! Anyone who's listened to years of public radio fund drives knows that it takes miles of tape to produce minutes of broadcast. That's where our dollars go. It's interesting to learn how the programs are put together, but deliver us from the naive angst of fear
fear of manipulation. We can hear just fine between the lines out here.
But Robert Moore of New York City said that all the editing is, quote, a dangerous exercise. I'm sure that you are aware just how little needs to be changed in any phrase to change completely the meaning or the implication of what was said. Perhaps it would be more honest to make the statement after each program that editing of material in OTM has taken place, but only to improve the flow of dialogue, and the editors believe that the meaning of any remarks broadcast were not altered from what the speaker intended, or something like that. I think there is a lot of mistrust amongst the general public regarding what they learn from the media, so anything that can be done to reestablish some trust should be worthwhile. Actually, we edited Mr. Moore's letter, and I don't think we changed the meaning. As always, we certainly tried not to, but I'm sure he'll tell us if we failed. We want to hear from you, so keep those letters coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
Over the years, we've often reported on the alternative media being produced by national Christian organizations. More often than not, these stories spotlight the so-called religious right, and mostly evangelicals, which has led some members of our staff to question whether we're neglecting the very significant block of American Christians who are not right-wing activists. This week, the liberal media watchdog group Media Matters for America released a report that echoed those concerns. It counted quotes and interviews of 20 well-known religious leaders, 10 deemed conservative and 10 progressive. And it found that the conservative leaders appeared almost three times as often as their progressive counterparts, on TV almost four times as often. Media Matters concluded that the imbalance is, quote, consistently advantageous to conservatives. Joining me now to discuss what's missing from mainstream religion coverage is the study's author, Paul Waldman. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Brooke.
Also here is Jeff Charlotte, a journalist who has written extensively on the Christian right. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Brooke.
So, first of all, Paul, did I pretty much sum up the study correctly? Did I miss anything really important?
No, that was the conclusion that we came to. When you look at those people who are asked to kind of represent what religious opinion is, the conservatives show up a lot more often than the progressives. And in our opinion, that gives a kind of a skewed picture of what the state of American religion is. When we say that it's advantageous to conservatives, what we mean is that, you know, that's one of the things that the Republican Party, I think, and many conservatives would like people to believe, that there's an equation between being religious and being conservative or being Republican. And that's actually not true. Although there are lots and lots of religious conservatives, there are even more religious moderates and religious progressives. So if you're going to accurately represent who religious America is, you can't just get those conservative voices.
So, Jeff, do you agree with Paul that the religious right is getting a disproportionate amount of attention, or do you think they deserve the attention that they get?
I guess I disagree with Paul on this. I think they're not getting enough attention. I think they started to get attention after 2004. After 2006 election, the immediate sort of assumption that the press made, as it always does when Republicans lose, is that the Christian right is a spent force in American life. They've been doing this since 1925 in the Scopes monkey trial. Meanwhile, we see evangelicals building new conservative coalitions that aren't getting any attention. So, for instance, one of the biggest conservative issues right now is AIDS. And that's great that they're paying attention to AIDS, but we need to pay attention to how they're paying attention to AIDS. For instance, stopping condoms from being distributed in Africa, abstinence-only education in American high schools.
Now, we should point out, Jeff, that in the past few years, you've made a living writing about the religious
yes,
right
I
and
have
its
an
leaders.
Incentive.
So why do you think these people deserve so much attention? Is it a matter of pure numbers or is it something else?
I think having spoken to these leaders over the years, the answer that they would give, and they give often, is that, you know what, abolitionists were a minority as well. Now, I personally don't see the similarity in their cause and abolition, but they do, and they understand themselves as social activists. So for us to say, hey, these people aren't important because they're not the majority, is, I think, to overlook the fact that they are able to push the agenda.
But at the same time, you know, right now, progressive religious leaders are becoming more organized. The conservatives have a couple of decades of head start on them on this, but they are starting to form new organizations. They're getting more involved in politics. And I think that that's a story that's not really being told in the mainstream news coverage, particularly by political reporters who are based in Washington.
I don't see this groundswell of progressive evangelicals. I see the people who buy Jim Wallace's book, Jim Wallace being a progressive evangelical leader. A lot of those people I've met, in fact, are conservative, traditional fundamentalists who also like this idea of their God being bigger than left or right. But that's not a progressive position.
If this particular right-wing contingent is organized and does vote in a bloc, then regardless of their hard numbers, aren't they worthy, Paul, of extra attention from the media?
They sometimes do vote in a bloc, although not completely. But one of the reasons is that, you know, they consume media too. And one of the messages that they get from the media is that if you are a strongly religious Christian, then you should be voting Republican because that's what strongly religious Christians do.
But that's not the message they're getting. When you spend time in conservative churches, the disdain for the Republican Party is so strong and has been since about the second year of Bush's presidency. And before that was really when I started focusing on that. I'm sure it goes back before that. They're voting this way because they're saying, look, you've got to vote this way if you're pro-life and you got to vote for the pro-life candidate. And if that's a Republican, you hold your nose because you don't like Republican ideas about how to deal with cities. And I encounter that all the time because cities are so important now to evangelicals. They don't like the Republican legacy on race, but they say pro-life is an issue on which they can't compromise.
Paul, don't you think by evaluating the situation as Media Matters' mission is to do along political lines that you're guilty of a little bit of reductionism when it comes to examining the coverage of religion in America?
Well, I think you could always uncover more and more layers of complexity. And one of the things that we wanted to do with this study was to just answer one very simple question, which is who is getting the attention when reporters try to write about religion and politics? We wouldn't say for a moment that that answers every question you could answer, but it's a start. We were trying to initiate a conversation so we could get started on the road toward encouraging a more complicated discussion of religion as it relates to politics.
I mean, I'd love to see them go beyond talking heads altogether. I think Jerry Falwell got as far as he did because people didn't understand that he, for many years, was an independent Baptist. And I think people would have questioned it if they said, oh, he doesn't speak for all Baptists in America. He speaks for his church. I hate to say this. I think the same thing would be said of Jim Wallace. I think there's this idea that Jim Wallace is at the head of an army of millions. The other thing that bothered me about the list of 10 on one side and 10 on the other side is, well, Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council gets X number of mentions in the media and Jim Wallace is behind them. And we can fix this by bringing Jim Wallace up to speed with Tony Perkins. So we'll go from 10 talking heads to 20 talking heads. And I don't see that as changing anything.
Well, I think that would be a narrow solution to the problem for reporters or producers to say, okay, well, when I quote Richard Land from the Southern Baptist Convention, then I'm also going to quote Bob Edgar from the National Council of Churches, a progressive. That wouldn't hurt, but I think that once the reporters start talking to a broader range of sources, they begin to expand their perspectives on the issues that they're talking about, and they begin to look at things in more complicated ways. So it's certainly one step to have a greater variety of voices that get quoted in the news. But that, I think, will in the end lead to a more nuanced and complex picture of these kinds of issues, hopefully.
I respectfully disagree. I think it's going to lead to just the opposite. It's going to give us the false impression of fair and balanced. I would propose instead an unrealistic solution, a modest proposal, a moratorium on all 20.
All 20 of Media Matters talking heads, 10 on one side, 10 on the other.
Let's stop talking to these people. And I think Media Matters would love this because then we would have to break this open and really go and talk to other people. You know, Jerry Falwell, as everyone within the Christian right knows, should not have been speaking for the Christian right for years and years. I think I saw a study, and correct me if I'm wrong, that Bill Clinton actually rated higher in popularity amongst evangelicals, conservative evangelicals, than Jerry Falwell. I mean, everybody knows a jerk when they see one, not to speak ill of the dead.
Well, it's good. We really span the spectrum here from sort of left to very left. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brooke.
Jeff Charlotte is the author of Jesus Plus Nothing, A History of American Fundamentalism, that's due out this fall. And Paul Waldman is a senior fellow at Media Matters for America and the author of Being Right is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Madeline Elish and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.